I'll always stand behind your son. And that's what his father said. But in a smoke-filled room, he only managed to pull out a pair of tins. Who will take his place while he goes to send a telegram? Dear Father, won't you stand behind me once again?
It was Nashville in the 1970s, and a Lexington boy had found some success.
Played in a club called the Exit Inn, and the owner of that, Owsley Manier, became a friend, and I played there often with people like Dan Fogelberg and John Hyatt. I signed a publishing contract with a man named Norbert Putnam, a really interesting producer. I think he did like Harvest Moon and that double Joan Baez album with The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down, really albums that I knew. And so they paid you $50 a week, you know, and whatever you wrote, they published.
Musician Jay Bolitan was playing songs with Merle Haggard and Kris Kristofferson, but touring was a tough gig. Jay quit Nashville and his other artistic pursuits took off.
I met a man in town here, a really famous gallerist named Carl Solway. Met him in New York in the mid-70s, and at the time, I was living way out in the forest in Kentucky, and he used to come down and see me, talk about art, and we did that for 2-3 years, and then he offered me a show, and I had a show here in Cincinnati, and I kind of followed my work here. I had 2 children here and raised them here. It's just been some place to do that, and here I am.
What followed was a career of monumental mechanical operas, woodcut motion pictures, and artistic collaborations. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Local artist and musician Jay Bolitan died in May at the age of 75. The Carnegie is exhibiting Jay's work July 18th and 19th with a public memorial July 20th. And the Northside Tavern will have a remembrance July 21st. Joining me in this recorded interview to talk about the artist and his legacy are the Carnegie Executive Director, Matt Distel. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you.
Studio Assistant, Emily Seitz. Thanks for being here, Emily.
Thanks for having me.
And Cincinnati author and performer, Mark Flanagan. Welcome, Mark.
Happy to be here.
Matt, the Carnegie is exhibiting some of Jay's work this month. What will visitors see in the gallery?
We're doing a little pop-up exhibition sort of inserted into the middle of our current exhibition, but with the help of the Solway Gallery, we're going to be showing some of the sculptures, a lot of the woodcut prints, and also some of the films. So just a little sampler of kind of the type of artistic output Jay had.
Yeah. Emily, you worked so closely with Jay for a number of years in his studio. What was his artistic process?
Oh, gosh. It would depend on which project he was working on at the time. He was so multifaceted. So working with the woodcuts, you know, he would draw out these very elaborate, deeply rich symbolic imagery that he would cut, and then he would pass the block on to me and I would print them. And then with the movies, you know, in between doing that, he'd be working on building sets, and there was just a constant flow of artistic expression going in many different directions.
Yeah, he seems like the kind of person who almost created like he breathed. He had to do it, huh?
Absolutely. It was a part of the way he moved through the world. Absolutely, yeah.
Matt, his work took so many forms, incorporating woodcut prints, these large sculptures. He began producing what he called mechanical operas in the 80s. Then in the late 90s, he began what became these woodcut motion pictures. So what's a mechanical opera and what's a woodcut motion picture?
Well, what are those things? Those things are very hard to define and describe, I think, because they have to be witnessed in some ways. The film being the most difficult thing to describe how it works, because he worked both in the analog and the digital world. So he was very much a man who liked to use his hands and was, you know, sort of connected to that style of working. And so even when he entered the digital realm, these things have a very physical presence and they feel like they live in a real world. And that's because they did. He would do these woodcut pieces, drawings that were meant to sort of create all of the characters and the sets and everything else for a film. And then he would insert them into real physical spaces that he built in his studio. And I think that was sort of the most recent types of work he was working on. But as it was informed by his earlier pieces, which were these mechanical opera pieces, which were large scale sculptures that could actually, someone could be inside them and manipulate them. Some of them worked, you know, totally mechanically. And he had exhibitions of these. They worked both as sculptures, and then he did projects with them where they were, you know, performers in larger stage sets. And yeah, I mean, the thing that we're doing at the Carnegie, I think it's also important to say, is not meant to sort of be a full exhibition of his work. This is something that just meant to accompany the memorial. Hopefully there will be plenty of full-scale retrospectives of his work in the future.
Mark, what's the experience like to watch a mechanical opera or one of these woodcut motion pictures? Do you have a way of putting that into words for people?
Well, I think at heart, Jay was obsessed with storytelling and refashioning myths and trying to make sense of his world. And he created his own world. And as Matt said, it's very hard to describe unless you experience it, because it's such a deep world that he created. And any kind of description of it is going to be lacking. It was kind of like a fantastical world. But in some ways, it was more real than the real world. And that's how I would describe it.
Were some of his stories kind of retellings of biblical stories? I'm thinking of the Jackleg Testament. And I mean, what sort of informed these stories?
Well, absolutely. They were all kind of variations, Jay Bolotin's versions of those. So the Jackleg Testament was a retelling of Adam and Eve, but instead of Adam, the second main character is Jack, who is a mannequin who was inside of a jack-in-the-box, and he stole Eve from Adam.
Matt, do you have thoughts about kind of just how to describe what it's like to watch these?
This is going to sound a little bombastic, but he invented a thing. I don't think a thing like this existed in the world before he did it. And the fact that he was sort of doing it as very talented people like M were helping him on this, but he was a bit of a one-man band. And the types of things that you could compare it to are the types of things that were happening in, you know, like major motion picture studios, you know. So like, I think they're impressive, but they're also like paced in this way that is like really sort of methodical. And I think the other thing that I love about, they're funny. There's a lot of humor in them. Jay gets things wrong intentionally. Like the one that he always liked to say was like, praise the Lord became praise the Lard, and the Lard becomes a character. And so it's sort of playing with it, with different accents and different ways of people seeing things and misinterpreting things and then moving off into their own mythologies.
Emily, you were in the middle of so much of this. What was it like to be in the middle of this creative process and then see what came of it in the end?
He really, truly, as Matt and Mark described, was creating these worlds and, you know, physically making them and then seeing them come to life on the screen was just absolutely the most magical experience. And I feel so lucky to have experienced it.
We're talking in this recorded interview about Cincinnati artist and musician Jay Bolotin, who died in May at the age of 75. Mark, you're a performing writer. You've had a very long-running column. You had a very long-running column called Exiled on Main. How did you become friends with Jay?
Well, Main Street back in the late 90s, early mid-90s, was kind of a hotbed of creativity. You had Caldy's Coffee House, which was kind of a clubhouse for artists of all stripes. So I knew Jay peripherally from that. I knew of his work. We became friends. A lot of my friends are visual artists, and a lot of them were either students of Jay's or peers who worked with Jay on his mechanical opera and built the sets, which were just massive, massive works of art. But our friendship really deepened when his when our mutual friend, Arely Strange, the poet and playwright, passed away, I feel like in some ways that Jay tried to step up and I had lost my mentor and kind of stepped into her shoes. So our friendship truly deepened at that point.
Well, and I believe you told our producer that he came to a lot of your performances too, right?
Yeah, so there's nothing like looking out, you know. You have these shows, you promote them, you prepare for them, you write them, and there's 12 people there. And inevitably, I'd look out there and Jay Bolotin would be out in the crowd. And there's nothing more heartening than that.
Jay's the father of Simone and Ezra. His daughter Simone wrote a statement for us. She wrote in part about her dad. "There are no words to describe the void that's been left in the world and in my life without him. He made my childhood magical, always respecting children as equals. It's hard to put into words the beauty and complexity of how his mind worked. He fused technology and the physical world to create animated motion pictures unlike anything that has been seen before, but never quite figured out how to use FaceTime. Delmore Recording Society, who recently re-released a record of his haunting folk songs from the 1970s, said it best. He was a man not of this world, a man from another time and space who crafted singular songs and art mined from the depths of his soul, where clocks tick backwards and characters walk but never arrive. He was a Renaissance man in search of a play worthy of his talent. They broke the mold when they made my dad, and I am eternally grateful to have been his daughter." Simone mentions that Delmore Recording Society, this record label, re-released a number of Jay's songs from the 1970s in 2018. Jay spoke with WGUC classical music host Elaine Deal in 2018 about working with Mark Lynn of Delmore on the release.
Mark Lynn, I think he had concentrated for some years on Mr. Christofferson's early demos, and apparently my name came up in researching some of that. And I got a call from him maybe 7 years ago. He was curious about these demos. And he managed, a lot of them had been destroyed or lost in fires or floods, and there was only one or two tapes anyway, I mean, of all those sessions. And I didn't really have anything, but he found things in people's basements and attics. And I mean, some of those archival labels are basically archaeologists in a way. And he had them restored beautifully, and I agreed to a release. It's been a long time, but I think sometimes time acts as a kind of tool, and time seems to have done those songs some good somehow. I don't know why.
Let's hear Jay's song, "The Picture in the Frame."
All right. Well, the leaves came swirling down on some old New England town with streets of a winding ancient nature. The farmers and the townsmen, they gathered there to speak of things they'd lately read in the papers. The air was turning cold and the wind was blowing bold, and there seemed to be some sort of autumn sale. They'd learned to pick and choose their garments well, and to stock and firm their shelters. Well, this stranger came on in as though he blew there with the wind. He wasn't lost, but neither was he found. This stranger stood out sharply in the crowd. These times they were perhaps not made for him. Well, he went into some store just for warmth and nothing more. And the lady there, she remembers him pretty well. This stranger stood out sharply in the crowd. These times they were perhaps not made for him. The other lady in the junk shop, she said he was the only one who asked about the foreign-looking picture. Some old and withered etching of a hero about to slay a wicked-looking creature. She gave it to him for free. She said it seemed to feel some need, and he's the only one my memory retains. Who did not shun the picture for the frame? No, he did not shun the picture for the frame. Came swirling down on some old New England town with streets of a winding ancient nature. The farmers and the townsmen, they gathered there to speak of things they'd lately read in the papers.
Simone says that's her favorite song on the album. Matt, for many artists, their relationship with a gallery is key. Can you tell us about Carl Solway and his long friendship with Jay and how he helped build Jay's success?
Yeah, sure. I mean, Carl is another one of those really important figures in the Cincinnati art scene. You know, he was, when Carl passed away, there was also another giant crater in this town. Man, hearing Jay's voice is the thing that gets you. I think Carl was really an important figure for Jay too. So, you know, he was the person who championed Jay's work and helped him have the resources to sort of create these really ambitious projects, which is not a thing a lot of galleries do, you know. And I don't know if Carl ever saw a return on Jay's work. I have no idea. I don't think that's what it was about. I think the economic model was abandoned when he started working with Jay, and the work that was created there is so epically important, and I think it's a legacy that's intertwined in Carl's legacy. Carl's son Michael has also kind of stepped in there and helped produce some of the newer bodies of work, and you know, I think that's also, it's continuing that legacy as well.
Yeah. In addition to the Carl Solway Gallery, Jay had the Weston Art Gallery's first solo exhibition when the Aronoff Center opened in 1995. Matt, how big a deal was that? It sounds like a big deal.
I was going to ask when that happened because I worked on that show. I was on the installation crew for that, helping to hoist those monsters in the air.
These were some of his mechanical creations from the operas.
Yeah, so it was the lobby, and the lobby looks maybe slightly different now, but it's pretty similar. And that was the first time I met Jay. You know, we didn't become friends until many years later. I also like to joke that knowing Jay for 30 years makes you one of his newer friends. But that show was really great. It was an amazing show. He was a great choice to sort of christen that space. And it's become a really great exhibition space for local artists, for artists to show their work. And it, you know, Dennis Harrington was also worked there then and is the director now, who's also leaving. So, you know, it's all of this feels sort of a piece that there's this like kind of important moments that happened in this town around visual arts and performing arts, and some of the main characters are leaving us.
Yeah. Matt, how did Jay change your creative work?
The thing with Jay was like, it felt really great to be brought into the fold and to just have these conversations. And we would meet for a sip of bourbon, maybe every 3 months or so, somewhere around that. Like, and he was very diligent about getting together. There was no agenda with it either. You know, like that was an important piece of meeting with Jay. It was the meeting with Jay was the thing. And I think that I've tried to sort of have those relationships with artists moving forward, and I learned a lot of that from Jay.
Yeah. What about you, Emily? How did Jay change your creative work and just the way you think about creativity? And
Jay changed so much of my life for the better. I was just thinking this morning about, you know, I saw a chipmunk run into a hole in our driveway, and it had a bunch of little like acorns and things that it was collecting. And just even looking at that and thinking like, oh, wow, this would make such a beautiful piece of a story. And, you know, so it's hard to move in the world and not be different after working with Jay. You know, I feel like my work forever will have a deepness and richness that was a gift given by Jay.
What about you, Mark?
Well, I think about how Jay approached his work. He stuck with woodcuts because he said it of the way it stayed on the page. Like even just a word when it was cut into the wood seemed to achieve an education, a right to exist. And so I find myself when I'm writing now that I want to have that, make that impression in my own way.
Been talking with the Carnegie Executive Director, Matt Distel, Studio Assistant, Emily Seitz, and Cincinnati author and performer, Mark Flanagan. Thank you all so much for talking with us about your friend today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Carnegie is exhibiting Jay's work July 18th and 19th with a public memorial July 20th, and the Northside Tavern will have a remembrance July 21st. You can find a link with more information on our website, wvxu.org. Technical director Marshall Verbsky is playing us out with some music from Jay's 1988 opera, The Hidden Boy. I want to note this came from a tape that was more than 30 years old that Marshall digitized for us. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is the talented Marshall Verbsky. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.